Yeah, so I can stay for a while. I have a train at 6:30 from Newton Abbot, so I think I should probably head off by if I can get a taxi for 5:30. So that means that gives us about an hour or so.
Yeah, I agree with about 95% of what you said. I may disagree with about 5%. And I was wondering why you lumped in various countries together. It seems to me there's a difference between countries like the UK and the USA and Greece, Spain, Italy, and so on. And the difference is the UK and the USA and various other nations such as Japan have not signed away their monopoly state right to create currency. And you said yourself, one security strategy you can adopt is to buy some government debt.
Yes.
So those countries that have their debt denominated in their own currency will not default in the sense of sovereign debt default.
Well, I wouldn't guarantee that, but there are important differences. I agree with you about that. I actually think it's going to be very difficult if one is, say, Greek or Portuguese or something, because it's very hard to hold cash in something that could be under threat as a financial instrument. This is a way in which the UK and the USA are better off because they do have their own currency. Problem with the euro is that it's less a single currency than it is a strong currency peg. The distinction is really that if you look at something like the US, the primary loyalty in the US is to the larger political unit. I mean, you're primarily American before you're Californian, for instance. There's less division. The primary loyalty is to the country. In Europe, that's not the case. You're primarily Portuguese or Spanish or whatever it might be before you're European. And there are a lot of divisions of language and culture and many other factors that go into creating enormous regional disparities in Europe. And so when you have this situation where you have a currency over these areas, but there are nevertheless very strong divisions in the sub-areas, what that does is encourage the speculators to have a field day, like when they drove the pound out of the exchange rate mechanism. And I can just imagine right now there are a whole lot of speculators rubbing their hands together in glee, waiting for the day they can force Greece out of the eurozone, because they'll make an enormous amount of money when they do. And they just keep betting against these places. I mean, they sent the Greek debt rates up to 18% before the bailout. They're 8% even now. Greece is not going to be able to sustain that. At some point, the speculators will win. And you will probably end up with the European periphery ending up not part of the eurozone anymore. It's not to say you don't have a euro, but it could be a much smaller eurozone than it is now. So if you're in one of these other countries, the risk, one of the risks to cash down the line is currency reissuing. That risk is very much higher if you are in the periphery of the eurozone than it is if you're in the UK or the USA, for instance. It's an important point, so I thought I'd expand on a little bit more on the situation for countries that are not in the eurozone, that you want to hold cash to start with, but cash is not a long-term option. Cash is a short-term mechanism for riding out a deleveraging and a deflation in the least risky way, which is not to say no risk, but less risk than almost anything else you could possibly do. Over time, though, there are a couple of risks that particularly come to mind. Governments can convert short-term bonds into long-term and then default on them, which is what Argentina did, or they can reissue the currency and then make it terribly difficult to convert from the old one to the new one, which is what Russia did. But neither of those things happen right away. So to start with, the risks to cash are very low, well, except for fire and flood and theft and the basic things. The common or garden risks are there. But the risk of the really major things happening with currency are lower in the short term. But what you do is as the prices come down, you take your cash and you move into hard assets over time. So then you're buying land and tools and water filters and things like that. But some people can afford to do it right now. They can afford to pay today's high prices and have no debt and have money. And so they might as well do it now because they bought themselves a learning curve, and that's valuable too. However, most people are not in that position. They can't have it all. They have to make harder decisions. The less money you have, the harder the choices you have to make. So for most people, they have to wait for prices to fall before they can afford to buy things with no debt. So they will have to hang on to cash for potentially quite a while, but the longer you hang on to it, the more these other risks start to grow. So it is a question of cash now, hard goods over time. Then when you get to a bottom, when the deleveraging is over and you hit a bottom, at that point you've probably actually broken the power of the bond market. The bond market is what prevents governments from printing right now. because if you print money, your interest rates will go through the roof and it'll be game over. There'll be a massive wave of debt default, which is deflation by definition. No, you can't print your way out of deflation. You just cause it even faster if you do. But so we're looking at cash, then hard goods. Once you've broken the power of the bond market, if the international debt financing model is broken by the bottom, then governments will absolutely print. Then you're Zimbabwe. But at that point, you have your hard goods. And that's the hedge against inflation.
But is it not also the case that governments are not forced to raise financing through issuing bonds? They could also spend money into existence debt-free.
Well,
this has been done at various points in economic history.
They can, but there are limits, because if they are seen to be an enormous risk, their interest rates will go up. Even if they're not constantly having to borrow everything, they are still going to be vulnerable to interest rate rises. So quantitative easing isn't actually money printing anyway. It's debt monetization, and that's just creating additional excess claims. It's not doing anything to increase underlying real wealth, and it's handing these excess claims to the very people best positioned to know that you have to cash them out right away. So it's actually enriching the center at the expense of the periphery, which is fairly obvious when you bail things out. Bailouts are only ever for the insiders. Ordinary people never get a bailout, unfortunately.
Is there a chance that things will get so bad that the economic system actually ceases to function and people can't, for example, begin to reclaim debt?
Reclaim debt?
Yes,
there'll be a wave of default. Absolutely. This debt is unrepayable. But that doesn't mean people won't try. And what they tend to do, when an entity thinks that it's not going to be able to reclaim, to get that someone to pay them, what they do is they sell that debt on to someone else who has a higher level of confidence that they will be able to get that debt repaid. And that can happen a number of times until your credit card debt ends up getting sold to Vinny the Kneecapper. And so there can be serious consequences to debt. And different people have different methods of extracting money from people whose debt they've bought. By the time you get it being bought by someone who really is a bottom fisher, he may be paying 2 cents on or 2 pence on the pound for that debt, which represents a 98% risk. He won't be able to get the money back, but he will succeed often enough that it will be worth his time. So there really are consequences to debt. It won't all be repaid. There's no way it can be. It's physically impossible. But people will try, and they will confiscate assets and do whatever it is, and they'll phone people up and pester them, and all manner of things can happen when people are holding debt that can't be repaid.
Mm-hmm. Is there any advantage in investing in ethical companies or green companies?
They would have to be very solid. The problem is that it's very difficult to make any money going forward if people don't have any. Now, if you're selling something essential to people, if they have any money at all, they're going to buy it. So in terms of an investment, you would want to make sure that what you were investing in was something that is likely to survive. So on a lot of things that have the appearance of being green does not necessarily mean that they're sustainable businesses that will survive. So there are other considerations besides whether something appears to be green. It really has to be a very strong business. Those things are not mutually exclusive at all, but not every company that is a good thing environmentally is going to be a good thing as an investment, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I sought some clarity on this holding cash issue. You seem to be saying that holding cash is sensible in the short term.
It is.
And not moving into property at this point in time.
Unless you have a lot of money. If you can do it...
What you're essentially saying, do it debt-free.
Yes, do it debt-free is basically the way to go.
I suppose...
You can, however, pool resources with other people. You get a lot further down the list if you pool resources with other people. That can make a huge difference, because then collectively you can do something debt-free an awful lot earlier than you would ever have been able to do it by yourself.
I suppose my question is, are you saying... you're not literally saying hold physical cash.
Yes, I am.
In your house.
Be creative. There are many ways to be creative, but not vast quantities. I tend to tell people, if you possibly can, at least manage 3 months. If you can manage a year, so much the better.
So what about larger quantities? What are you saying during that?
Gilts, short-term government debt. Because you don't want to keep £1 million in your basement. That would be silly. If the currency gets reissued at some point, and then you have to turn up at whatever area you're supposed to convert money to, and you have an enormous quantity of money in your hand, the government will assume that you were up to no good and will probably issue a windfall tax and things. So you don't want to hang on to vast quantities of it in physical form. Gilts are the next best option.
So you're saying this the guarantees that the government's currently giving to banks, things up to 50,000, are you saying it's just not... It's
a confidence game. They haven't got the money to pay that back. They will not be able to do it. Not any deposit insurance scheme. They haven't got a thousandth of the money they would need.
Why don't they guarantee that over the government debt? Over the gilt, sorry.
Well, it's simply a question that the government will be standing longer than almost anything else. Again, it's not a long-term thing. This is not something you put your money in there and then forget about it and think, oh, good, that's safe. Because there are risks to do with that, too. So, I mean, primarily, the idea that they might convert short-term debt to long-term. The problem with long-term government debt is that if interest rates are going up in the bond market, the price of the bond is going down, which means this is not a capital preservation strategy because you're losing the principal or a substantial percentage thereof because you're dependent on selling them into the secondary market. That's what you want to avoid. With short-term debt, you're not selling them into the secondary market. You just wait until the government gives you your money back in 30 or 90 days. And in America, anyway, you don't even have to roll it over. You can just put it in Treasury Direct account, buy the bonds, with short-term bonds once, let them mature, and the money goes back into that same account. So you're using the U.S. Treasury as your bank account. Don't think you can do that in the U.K., but still, you can keep just rolling it over, and then you can always get it out at short notice if you need to. But there are risks that grow with cash and cash equivalents. The risks grow over time. That's why it's a risk-benefit analysis between hanging on to your cash long enough for asset prices to come down to where you can afford them, but not so long that the risks of holding cash start to get higher. And one of the things I think America might do is potentially down the line they might reissue currency, not to smoke money out from under the bed. That's why Russia did it, because nobody in Russia trusted the banks anyway. Everyone kept money under the bed. So they reissued the currency in order to eliminate the purchasing power of the middle classes, and they did it very successfully. In somewhere like the States, and here too, I mean, nobody keeps money under the bed in America. That would serve no purpose to try and smoke it out. You would get the occasional person, and then you could windfall tax those few people. But the main reason I think America might do it is because there's an enormous number of dollars held by foreigners. And you would wipe the value off those at a stroke, totally, because they would have no opportunity to convert from the old currency to the new if the currency was reissued. So if America does it, it'll be to target foreigners primarily, I think. There are a lot of countries where they use the dollar as a de facto currency, and those people would be completely out of luck.
If we're to say that the pound is a new money in the pound, and also the euro, and there's no point putting your money into the dollar because of everything we just talked about.
Well, that's further down the line. That doesn't happen immediately. So if you are interested in currency speculation, the dollar is likely to do very well for a year or two. And within that period of time, you probably could buy dollars and then still be able to get out of them again before you were seriously into the danger zone. That does, currency speculation does add another layer of risk, but for some people the risk will be worth it because they are potentially going to make a decent return on doing that. If the pound and the euro are falling, the dollar and the yen are both likely to go up. The yen carry trade will unwind, so the yen will probably go up possibly more than anything else. But the dollar should do well, A, because of a knee-jerk flight to safety. Capital flight leaves Europe and ends up in the U.S. on a mistaken perception of safety. But also there's more dollar-denominated debt than any other kind in the world. And as dollar-denominated debt deflates, as people try to pay that back, that creates a demand for dollars. So that pushes up the value of the dollar relative to other currencies as well.
And that's why you would include the Swiss franc in that bracket?
Well, I tend to think keep your currency speculation to a minimum if you can, because there are risks to do with that, and it isn't always obvious exactly which way one thing will go relative to another. So it is definitely a risk. And there are risks in terms of just being able to get back into your own currency when you need to. Some of these avenues can get shut off down the line. So then you're stuck in the wrong kind of currency. There are always risks like that. I mean, Eastern Europe, people are finding out that it was a really bad idea to take out mortgages in yen, which is what a lot of them did, unfortunately, because the yen was falling. They were talked into that being a good idea. The yen is probably going to go through the roof. And so they've added currency risk to the debt risk that they were already carrying, which would be an absolute disaster for them.
Well, Japan is in the middle of a perpetual political
crisis.
That
they are. Mm-hmm. But the carry trade will unwind. At some point, the Japanese interest rates are going to start spiking because Japan managed to stave off having to deal with the bad debt in their banking system because they had an enormous amount of money in the bank, so to speak, which they have now burned through. They managed to keep going because they had functioning export markets. However, when their export markets die because people, the consumers don't have any money, it's game over for Japan. Their interest rates are going to go up sharply, and that will absolutely start to unwind the yen carry trade. And the other side of the yen carry trade was often the Australia and New Zealand dollar. So as the yen goes up, those currencies will go down probably like a rock.
So what do you mean by the yen carry trade?
Well, that's where you would borrow money in Japan at 0.5% and take it to New Zealand and buy bonds there for 7%. So you're extracting liquidity from one source and making money on the trade in moving the money around. So the yen carry trade was an enormous engine of liquidity for years and years and years during this almost perpetual stagnation of the Japanese economy. But Japan is not going to be able to continue that kind of stringing out the pain. And we won't be able to do what Japan did because, for one thing, we don't have a whole lot of money to burn through and we don't export anything anyway. So we're just not in a position to string it out. Ours is going to be more like Argentina than like Japan.
Land values. Touched on them slightly. What curve will take place in land value?
Well, I think they're going down a lot, very sharply, very quickly. What you get to start with is an enormous amount of inventory. People start to try and sell, and then nothing moves. Prices don't fall immediately. The whole thing just goes illiquid. You just don't get things changing hands at all until people start to get desperate enough to take very much less money. And that's when you really start to break the back of the property market. But a lot of people will chase the market all the way down. They'll cut too little, too late, and they'll follow the market down.
That's a house, or is it agricultural land?
Well, to some extent, it will be both. Agricultural land would probably hold more value and would recover value that much sooner, I would think, than houses and things, because it has more inherent value. But nevertheless, I mean, in the States in the Depression, some of the best farms in the country were foreclosed on, and at auction, no bids. Yes. And not because
same
these things
here.
Weren't worth anything.
Same here. Yeah. You could farm land, people would give you land, it went free.
Yeah, because if nobody is prepared to part with the money, there is no value at that point in time. Doesn't mean there isn't later. The seeds of the great fortunes are sown in times like these because people preserve liquidity at the top, asset prices plummet, and then the world is their oyster. When everyone else is finding that even as prices fall, affordability is getting worse because they have no money, if you actually preserve cash now, the purchasing power will be incredible. You have almost everything to choose from. So, I mean, some people will do very well, thank you, out of this. Not without risk to themselves, of course, because if one is entirely too predatory and is too obviously a vulture, then there's typically a social price to pay for that one way or another. But yes, I mean, you can do very, very well. And if one wants to be socially responsible about it, not just simply looking at how can I make a mint out of this, but you can say, well, I will preserve this cash as liquidity, then I can look after a community on the downside. Then I can buy a farm that I can turn into an intentional community. I can start this and this and this and that for the benefit of a wider group of people. So anything that can be extracted from the system now can look after a lot more than just you going forward. And some people will have resources, other people will have skills. Whatever you can pool, so much the better.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that you mention this, like, I've been entertaining the idea of selling my apartment because I have a little property and use the money to actually build a sustainable house. Like, would it be now the right moment for that?
Oh, I would think so. Yes, I mean, as long as you don't have to take on debt. So if you're going to build something, if you can build it cheaply, especially if you know how to do these things yourself and you've got access to the land, then yes, now would be a great time to do that. I mean, it depends on your circumstances to a point. I mean, that does mean you will have a certain amount of your money tied up in property, which will be worth a lot less. But if you don't owe anything on it, you don't really have to care, as long as you have enough money that you'll be able to pay the higher property taxes on it and you're not going to get too squeezed with access to cash. Then yes, a sustainable house would be great. Probably better than an apartment, especially if it's one that you own. rental apartments are not such a bad idea because you've got the whole mobility thing. Owning an apartment tends to mean that you just don't really have a lot of ability to take any kind of control over the essentials of your own existence. And so that's a bit of a sticky situation. And you have often structural dependencies you can't do very much about. So a sustainable house would be better, certainly.
Mm-hmm. I realize it's hard to make predictions within an exact time frame, mm-hmm. but I'd be really interested to hear your opinion on mm-hmm. how you see things maybe playing out within the next 6 months to 2 years, particularly in relation to the UK and Europe.
I think we're going to start seeing credit markets seriously fall within the next 6 months. And where credit markets lead, the real economy will follow. So we're going to start to see the beginnings of what's coming. I think the worst of the effects in the real economy are probably next year rather than this year. It's hard to say, though, because these things are swings of positive feedback. They start slow, but they can build up a kind of critical mass, and all of a sudden, in September 2008, I believe we came within about 6 hours of the entire banking system seizing up globally. So these things can happen almost overnight. And capital flight's very quick, too. In the peso crisis, Mexico lost a quarter of its foreign reserves in 6 hours. Simply because people phoned up and said, get my money out of Mexico, and it's electronic. It can happen very quickly. So one can't be complacent about these things. And it's far better to be early, even a year or more too early, than 5 minutes too late. So you do have to be aware that things can unfold very quickly once they get going.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask something else. Mm-hmm. I would like to ask, how do you envision the social communities? Obviously, as a foreigner here in the UK, I'm just wondering, I'm a bit worried, regarding the questions of citizenship, because now, for example, the Greek crisis, we already mm-hmm. see that European citizenship is is decreasing, or people are being mm-hmm. more and more afraid, and social conflicts tend to rise.
That absolutely happens during contractionary times.
Yeah, sorry, okay. I just want to mm-hmm. continue, and I'm just wondering, in the future, because we now tend to live together in communities. Maybe one scenario could be that the people who don't have the national citizenship mm-hmm. will be thrown out.
Because that's often, possible.
Yeah, because often there's xenophobia and social mm-hmm. Conflicts almost like yeah. to be with systemic crises.
Yes, because when you have an expansion, people tend to think in terms of common humanity and inclusion. When you have a contraction and there's not enough to go around, people remember why they didn't like each other once before. And unfortunately, the cracks that get papered over during expansions tend to be revealed again. So yes, things like that can happen. To some extent, there are other factors as well, and how long someone has been there, what social network they have, to what extent they really are embedded in a system, whether they actually have legal citizenship or not. But yes, it is definitely a concern to be somewhere. It's easier if you're somewhere your face thoroughly fits, so to speak. And it's a shame. Multiculturalism is a fabulous thing. I mean, it's extremely enriching for all concerned, I think. However, it doesn't do so well in times of contraction, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the government in the UK has recently introduced the feed-in tariff, whereby people get an income.
We did that too.
Energy generation, and in principle, mm-hmm. that 25 years of income is guaranteed to be paid from energy companies.
Mm-hmm. In theory, yes.
How do you see that playing out? Because that's a 25-year mm-hmm. guarantee plus inflation.
I think they will probably unilaterally repudiate those contracts when they become a huge political liability. And governments don't fight fair. They can make promises and break them. They can change the rules retroactively, unilaterally. And what I can imagine them doing is down the line a few years, when demand for power is falling, in that initial phase where demand is going down and you haven't had a supply crunch yet, you can end up with way too much of something. And then if you're paying a premium price for renewable power, I can imagine a government coming to power and saying, there's political capital to be made by saying, look at these greedy people over there. Look what they're getting when you people over here are suffering. We should just repudiate their contracts. So you can build up an enormous head of steam and end it with a political mandate to do things like that. So I think guarantees, 20, 25-year guarantees are not worth the paper they're written on. They're really not. Especially, people have to take on a lot of debt often to put in these systems. And the farm-based biogas systems that I used to work on, farmers have to take on $2 million of debt to do that. They have to mortgage the family farm. And then if they're not going to get the tariff that they were promised, they could just lose everything. It's really awful. I mean, people who can afford to do it without debt are in a different position than anything that they make. Well, it's a bonus. But if you end up having to deal with debt that then becomes almost impossible to service, that's a really sticky situation to be in. I don't think there's any way anyone can make 20 to 25-year guarantees about anything right now. The amount of upheaval coming down the line is just so enormous that it's likely to blow a lot of arrangements out of the water, I really think.
Mm-hmm. I have a sister who lives in Greece. I have two mm-hmm. questions. Should she take her money as savings out of euros?
It's a hard one in places like Greece because normally you'd want to hold cash, but I don't have a really clear idea of what kind of time frame we might be looking at for somewhere like Greece to end up being driven out of the eurozone. So it's a sticky one. And it might make sense in the case of someone who is Greek to consider holding American dollars for a period of time. Not a long time, because if there's a currency reissuing, they wouldn't have any money. But they end up in a situation where there are fewer choices available, and especially fewer good choices. So I don't think if I was Greek right now, I would want to sit on an enormous pile of euros.
My other question was mm-hmm. that the Greek people, some were saying no to this mm-hmm. rescue package, and mm-hmm. I did wonder about that, sort of based mm-hmm. on the Naomi Klein sort of version mm-hmm. of economics.
Oh, yes. Everyone should read The Shock Doctrine, by the way, by Naomi
Brilliant.
Klein. It's absolutely superb.
And I wondered if they were deliberately trying to break Greece.
Oh, they probably are. Yeah. And what's happening at the moment is the centre, which is primarily Germany, but the centre is basically trying to say to the periphery, you were greedy, it's all your fault, now you're going to live in austerity for years and years and years, and we don't want to know about any of your pain on the whole. They are making some noises about us all being in this together, but at the moment it's really not anything real about all being in it together. If you try and force all the pain to remain in the periphery while the money remains at the center, that is a recipe for horrible political division. The only way to have any chance, I think, of keeping the eurozone together is to say, we are all in this together and we will all take a haircut. You know, and Germans are not likely to want to hear that because they're going to think, well, it was their fault, they were greedy. However, in a predator-prey relationship, it takes two. You don't have a system without the predators and the prey. Everyone has to regard themselves as mutually responsible. So, I mean, for instance, it's comparable to, say, predatory lending in the States and the subprime crisis. You know, if you go to people who've never had access to any credit and you say, I'll lend you all this money. Look, you can have that lovely home over there. You know, they're being inveigled into something. So it's not just a question of people being greedy at the bottom, and there is an element of that, but people also being very predatory at the top. And people have to recognize that as being a joint responsibility for having created an unsustainable credit crisis. Because all these things for inveigling people into debt are very much like, you know, the witch with the gingerbread house and saying to Hansel and Gretel, come here and I'll give you a lollipop. You know, that's exactly the kind of scenario that people have got themselves in. It was very tempting, but they are now in a trap if they've gone that way. And it's not entirely their own fault they're in a trap. They were inveigled to be there.
Can I just add, my sister said that it's the French and Germans who lent them the money.
Well, yes.
Came and built roads and Olympic stadiums, took the money for that. The Greeks spent what money they had on German and French cars.
Yes.
Now it's the Germans and French who are saying they can't have any money.
Well, and yes, the centre is trying to hang on to the money and inflict all the pain on the periphery.
Yeah.
And that is extremely politically divisive. It's very much one of the forces that could drive wedges through the heart of the European Union, which is so sad because the European Union really did have, you know, a lot to offer. And the idea of European unity, I think, is a great one. But unfortunately, that sort of thing is very difficult to sustain in contractionary times where people start to fight over almost everything, mostly bicker at this point. And I'm not talking about them actually repeating any very unfortunate lessons of the past, but nevertheless, they remember why they didn't like each other. And some of these things go back an awfully long way. I mean, I remember seeing Serbian people, for instance, tears in their eyes on the anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo Polje, because it was the defining event in their history. It was 600 years ago. And I would say, get over it. You know, we don't live in that world anymore. There is no point being emotionally invested in the things that are long gone, but people are nonetheless. And Europe has rather a lot of situations like that, where you had all sorts of regional powers, and a lot of them tend to think of the natural boundaries of their own territory as being whatever it was as its greatest extent, which means they all overlap. So that there are unfortunate dynamics in Europe that don't apply to quite the same extent in places like North America, for instance. Mind you, they have their own problems.
Are there less painful ways out of the problem, and are there ways of preventing it happening again? I'm thinking of sort of economics which don't rely on growth.
Well, people will definitely do that. Unfortunately, that's not going to prevent what's happening now. All the re-regulation they're trying to do is very much locking the barn door after the horse has bolted. So you're not going to prevent it. You're not going to prevent it being painful. However, there are things you can do to make it less painful than it would otherwise have been, which is very much what you're talking about doing here. And that sort of thing is extremely important. It really does matter. But nevertheless, it is going to be painful, and for quite a long time, too. But people will move to hard currencies or a no-growth model and things like that. Unfortunately, you can't stop future generations from forgetting the lessons of the past. I mean, we have forgotten the lessons that our grandparents learned in the Depression. We allowed it to happen again. What tends to happen is the laws that are brought in after the fact to control these things tend to last just about long enough until they would be useful again, in which case they're dropped. So all the regulations that were brought in the late 1930s were dropped again in the 1980s, just in time for everything to expand again. So they had laws, for instance, in the US that prevented investment banks from gambling with their depositors' money. And they got rid of those laws in the deregulation. So lo and behold, the investment banks gambled with their depositors' money, and now that money isn't there. So if more than a tiny percentage of people turn up at the bank and ask for their money in cash, it's game over for the banking system. They don't have it. It's already gone. The losses have already happened. They just haven't been revealed yet. And they aren't revealed until you get something like people turning up at a bank and saying, I'd like my money, please. Or somebody trying to sell a derivatives contract and then finding, oh dear, it's worth 5 cents on the dollar. All of a sudden, then the fact that the losses have already happened becomes obvious.
Mm-hmm. Is it practical for people in this room to hold gilts, and how do we go about that?
Well, I'm not the best person to ask about the mechanics of purchasing things in the UK, because it's not something I do and I don't live here, so there would be people who would be better positioned to tell you about that than I would. They might disagree with your decision to do it. You might have to say, no, I insist. but there would be people who would be better able to tell you about the mechanics of that than I would.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm not alone in this. I think that what I'm juggling the whole time with every question that's asked is, what do I have to do to mm-hmm. make myself and my family secure and sustainable in the situation, and to what extent am I taking on the mutual responsibility angles and the messages that you put up on the screen earlier about we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. I just want to say that in relation to things that were said a little while ago about, for example, the kind of tensions that come out in these situations, we had a lot of discussion about blame, for example, and I think that's a big one that we're all heading into. Is,
oh, the blame game will be huge.
Of the blame game that is going to get bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. Shami Chakrabarty, who you may know...
It's a name I recognise, but I can't remember in what context.
Liberty, which is, I think, potentially a very important organisation in this situation, actually happened to visit our area. And after she'd given a whole talk about things to do with Liberty, I just asked her a question with that. She didn't know who I was or where I was coming from, any of my priorities. And I just asked her, what, looking ahead to the next 20, 30 years, do you see as the biggest problem for you and your organisation? The first two words she said were climate change. Now, I think that we need to establish some kind of a dialogue with organisations like that, because whatever I can do to secure my own self and personal property and all the rest of it in this situation is likely to be swamped by all the other things that you've envisaged here. For example, I live in a rural area. Mm-hmm. I can grow my own vegetables, but I'm aware they're not very far away from where I live. They're from where I live. There are people who live in urban conurbations that could run out of everything.
Yes.
And no matter whether I've got photovoltaic cells on the roof, firewood...
It's whatever. Harder in England, where the distances are really short. You can't get very far away from anything.
Fear and blame.
Yes, absolutely.
Biggest of all. But, of course, I can't say that I'm not at the same time thinking, do I sell this or do I buy that? It's just like other people here, too.
Yes. There are a lot of challenges, and they're going to be hard decisions and a lot of risk-benefit weighing up to do that will be totally individual. And so there's certain general principles, but to a large extent it's going to be down to the very nuts and bolts specifics of your own situation as to what the best way to go about that is. And
on that note, can I just ask you to talk about Canada, because I know you're supposed to be connected. I have a connection there too, so you haven't actually mentioned Canada. You talk about the dollar, but I presume you're talking about the US dollar.
The US dollar.
So could you just fill us out?
Canada is living in cloud cuckoo land, and they are just so divorced from reality, it is absolutely unreal. It's one of the biggest bubbles in the world. I mean, the average house price in Vancouver is over $1 million. No, it's nuts. And if you look at these things, we had a post on our site a while ago that said mansion or a crack house, because there was this horrible property, but it was worth $1 million because it was in Vancouver. And you know, unfortunately, Canada thinks it's an energy superpower and that they think all these problems are somebody else's problems. They don't have anything to worry about. You know, it's completely ridiculous. They are so far in denial, it's unreal. So there's an enormous comeuppance coming for Canada. However, and the reason I'm there, well, I had family there, and I could be at least moderately self-sufficient there in a way that I couldn't here. So I opted to move there 10 years ago, I mean, partly because I'm a country person anyway, and I could never afford a farm in the UK at all. But, you know, for me, that was the right decision to make. However, There are a lot of issues there too, absolutely. I worry about living next door to the US, quite frankly, because my main worry for the US is fascist theocracy. And that's not something that I'm remotely comfortable with living next door to. However, you know, you have to live somewhere, and I worry about what's happening in Europe with the potential instability. And there are various things here. I think fascism is not impossible here either. I don't think it'd be the theocratic kind, but you know, no fascism is nice. You know, I think liberty is going to be a casualty of things going forward, and unfortunately, almost no matter where you are. And I think it was Benjamin Franklin who said, "He who trades liberty for security shall enjoy neither." And that's very much the case. But frightened people do give up their civil liberties, and they don't realize that you're never getting them back again unless you fight for them all over again. But frightened people do these things. They allow their liberties to be taken away from them. And to some extent, you may need certain greater central powers if you're going to have something like rationing, for instance, like after World War II. You know, there's some sense to a rationing system if there's not enough to go round. However, that does require centralized powers, and centralized powers are a double-edged sword, because even the people who assumed those powers or were given them, even if they had the best of intentions, which they probably wouldn't, but even if they did, their successors wouldn't necessarily. Powers once given are typically abused at some point down the line. So I think we are moving to a less free society. And I think that is going to be something none of us are going to like at all. We're very, very used to having freedom of action. There's really nothing as addictive as freedom.
Canada's armed forces are too enough right now, isn't it?
Well, Canada's armed forces are really nothing to write home about in armed forces terms. And you know, they're a bit of an embarrassment by anybody else's scale. And it's an enormous country. There's no way you could actually arm it in any way that would make it remotely defensible against anybody else's military. It's sort of a fig leaf, really. But yeah, they're in Afghanistan, and unfortunately, protecting the poppy trade and things, unfortunately. The poppy trade, which has flourished since the foreign troops moved into Afghanistan, which was not there before. So you know, there are some very unfortunate effects to occupations.
I guess the hardest problems or the greatest problems to overcome would be in more urban areas, heavily, densely populated.
They can be. Rural areas can be quite unstable, though, and rural poverty can be quite unforgiving. I mean, if you're on a farm and you find you're not as self-sufficient as you actually thought you were, and you have a couple of bad years, you might have to leave because there might simply be no way to live there. And what happens in a lot of parts of the third world is people end up leaving the countryside because it's terribly poor and often terribly unstable as well, and they end up in these enormous conurbations living in shanty towns.
Yeah. And I guess it's about measuring that resilience that
yes.
the community has got together
in yes.
whichever area you live.
You can either be urban or you can be rural. It's the things in between that don't really work. So if you're rural, you have to understand that you're kind of on your own. You better be self-sufficient, or at least some way there. You better at least have, you know, well and septic and grow your own food and things like that if you're going to be in a truly rural area, because otherwise you just have ridiculously long supply lines, and that's a vulnerability. If you're in an urban area, well, you're throwing in your lot with the great and the good, the wealthier people on the whole who... And services, if they're going to survive, are going to be in places with small areas. So you're more likely, you're more dependent on those services, but they're more likely to survive if you're in an urban area. People tend to flock to urban areas because that's where the only economic opportunities are, and that's where the only relief programs are as well. Relief programs don't extend out into the countryside. So you do tend to see, pretty much across the world, where times are hard, people are migrating to cities in enormous numbers. So unfortunately, you're getting an enormous growth of slums in an enormous number of parts of the world. And that certainly could make an appearance in places that haven't seen them before.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, to go back to a specific example. Mm-hmm. We're just setting off to spend a year researching, mm-hmm. traveling around Britain, researching, building an eco-house and a sort of transition mm-hmm. community type thing. And we have actually got some cash mm-hmm. in savings and property in a place which we don't want to live in. What would you recommend?
I would definitely sell it now. If you're going to sell it, you sell it as soon as you possibly can. And I wouldn't hold out for too high a price either. And you know, if you hold out too long, you're likely to get less in the end. And the way to price something is to price it at about 5% below the market value. Price it too high and no one will even look at it. Price it even slightly under the market value, people might come and compete over it. You might even get more than you're asking. Depends on where it is and what sort of thing it is. But if you get the psychology right, so you seem to be offering a bargain, people will fight over a bargain and you actually get a pretty decent price in the end.
And so if we don't know where we want to build this eco-house set up at the centre, what do we do with that cash, the capital?
I would say most of it you'd probably want to put in gilts, because you couldn't hold that much money. It wouldn't make sense to hold that much money in cash, even if you could get it, which you probably couldn't. You know, if you walked up to the bank and said, "Can I have £400,000 in cash, please?" they would immediately assume you were some kind of criminal or something, and you would probably immediately get audited. So there are certain things you don't want to do that just would not make sense, but you can put it in gilts and it doesn't create any problems for you. And then that's something that's temporary. As soon as you find the property that you want, then you can put the money into that instead.
So. And there's no chance of gilts being...
It's not that there's no chance. There's risk everywhere, absolutely everywhere. There are no risk scenarios. I don't think they'll collapse. The risk, I think, with short-term government debt is that it could be converted to long-term. But I don't think that happens. The chances are, I think, that it doesn't happen soon. It may happen down the line, but you typically get some warning with things like that. It's not like you can flick a switch and it happens overnight. Often there are warning signs. And I mean, we try and really watch what's going on at our website. And so we were able to give people 6 months' notice that the Icelandic banks were going under, and about 3 months' notice that Lehman's was going under as well, because the information is out there if you know what you're looking for. Most people don't, but we are in the business of trying to give people as much of an early warning as we can. Which is not to say we're not by any means infallible, but we at least have an idea what to look for, and we are actively looking for it. So we try and help where we can, but we make no promises to be infallible or any such thing.
So then what would be a safe kind of time to leave them in there?
I would think you should be fine for at least a couple of years, and quite likely longer. And usually cash and cash equivalents are safe for the period of deleveraging. 5 years is probably a bit too long, really. But you know, I would think you'd want to try and get yourself settled as soon as you can on the whole, because for one thing, you're going to need learning curve time. And if you've got the money to do it with no debt, buying yourself a learning curve is an extremely valuable thing to do. Because if you buy yourself a farm or something, you have to learn how to use it. So, and you have to give yourself time to make mistakes. It's a dig your well before you're thirsty principle. That if you do it in advance, then you've figured it out, you have time to make mistakes before you have to rely on the results. So that sort of thing is important.
Mm-hmm. Would you sell out pensions, please?
I think the problem with pensions is that you get the same problem as with bank runs. that a few people can actually make early withdrawals, certainly in the States. I don't know the exact pension law here as to whether you can take things out in advance. I would expect, if it's in the States, you can, but you pay a tax penalty. I reckon that it's worth getting a certain percentage of something rather than 100% of nothing, which is more likely to be what happens. Because once a trickle becomes a flood and more people start taking it out, well, the money isn't there, so they're going to shut the door on that particular option. And they won't tell you that that's what they're doing. What they'll say is, people appear to be depleting their pensions. We can't have them throwing away their retirement. For their own good, we will have to prevent early withdrawals. What they mean is, we don't have your money, but we don't want you to know that now. So they don't want to frighten people. These things get spun in all sorts of ways. They won't tell you the real reason for doing things. But I do think that that door will be shut, and a lot of other doors too. Doors like relatively civilized bankruptcy. Again, when trickle becomes a flood, they don't want to let everybody off the hook. So you start to get more and more consequences to debt. I mean, there are places in the States. There was an article just this last week in the States about people actually being imprisoned for debt. Debtor's prison was abolished 100 years ago. But in some cases, even although there is no legal basis for doing it, there are people who have been jailed over non-payment of credit card debt, which is insane. I mean, where's the rule of law in that? It is not legal to jail someone for non-payment of credit card debt. But there are instances where people are finding that the criminal law is being used against them in ways that there is no foundation for. Things like that do happen in bad times, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. We have the possibility of selling our assets here and moving to Brazil. Mm-hmm. That's rather radical.
Yes.
I have a Brazilian wife and Brazilian daughter.
Do you speak Portuguese?
And I speak Portuguese
that
as
helps.
Well, and the transition is building in Brazil. It does seem quite a possibility. Do you have an opinion about the BRICS or about Brazil and the countries like that?
South America is probably not a bad bet, I would think. I mean, they do have things like the potential to produce ethanol from sugarcane in a way that makes an enormous amount more sense than doing it from corn. There are some good things about it. You would want to feel fairly comfortable living in a place like that. Definitely helps if you've got Portuguese family, Brazilian family, because their faces will fit. You know, I'd say that's not a bad option on the whole. China and things, if you're looking at the other BRICS, well, India is going to be in terrible trouble because they're going to be horribly water constrained, and the level of population in the space of that they have available, that is not looking good for them at all. The water tables are falling by feet per year in parts of India. They're already bringing water up from 600 feet down in places. As soon as you lose the cheap energy, you can't do that anymore. And with climate change melting the glaciers, you could lose the summer rainfall supply, the non-monsoon season surface water supply, too. So, I mean, there are a lot of problems coming down the road for India. China is an enormous bubble, and there's a tremendous amount of bad debt in their banking system. They're definitely going to have an enormous setback. Plus, the breadbasket of China is Manchuria, and it's about to go through its own version of the Dust Bowl, water scarcity again. And they have an enormous population, too. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if an awful lot of Chinese people ended up moving to other places. It's already happening. This is what empires in ascendancy do. It's very much what we did when we were in that position. So it's not like we can really blame them for it. But I mean, they're already buying up enormous amounts of assets in Africa, for instance. And the Chinese population in Africa is increasing quite rapidly. So you are getting forms of colonization. And so that is, they're looking for Lebensraum, basically. Right now, I mean, they're primarily looking for the economic assets. But where the economic assets have been taken possession of, the people will follow. So I think there are a lot of problems in various BRIC countries. But things like South America are probably not too badly off on the whole. They're a little bit away from some of the worst things that have gone on in the industrialized countries. So.
Mm-hmm. You said you had to get the train at 5:30.
Yes, I have to get a taxi at about 5:30, so that's in about 25 minutes, and I haven't actually phoned them yet, so I will have to do that. Somebody did put up a list of taxi companies. Somebody actually put them up, but I haven't had a chance to consult them yet. I don't have a car, so...
No,
hmm?
So bus. you need a break then to sort that out? You know, so you're not missing a train.
Might be a good idea.
I head to the station if you like. If that's easier, I'll lift to the station.
That would be lovely. My train's at 8:30. Newton Abbott. Yeah, I will have to stuff some things in a bag as well. So, my stuff tends to get flung when I'm trying to look for the right thing, and then I deal with it later. So I still have to deal with it before I can actually go. But the train isn't 6:30.
Will you ever be coming back this way?
Oh, I certainly hope so. I love England. It's a wonderful place, and I've spent almost half my life here. And I love traveling.
This is like the last world tour, you're like a pop group.
Your motivation is, because you've been very generous with your expertise and your time with Sergeant.
This is my public service.
What is it that you want to do? What's your goal? What's your aim?
Well, I want to do what I can with the knowledge that I've been putting together all these years. What's the point of doing that if it's not going to be useful to somebody? I couldn't sleep at night if I didn't go around and warn people. And I couldn't do my day job and this anymore. So I decided, no, this is what has to be done. This is the important thing. Plus, I didn't want to be telling farmers they should take on $2 million worth of debt to build a biogas plant. Anyway, so this just seemed to be the sort of thing that mattered the most that I could be doing. So I'm traveling around all over the place and sleeping in people's spare rooms. I stay with people I've never met all over the place, and it's fine. So I try and do it at the minimum amount of cost and things. So to make it doable.
Have you got details of your lecture tour?
They're mostly on the website. It's a still developing itinerary. So I'm flying to Amsterdam tomorrow. So I'm doing a talk in Amsterdam on the 14th. Then I have to do some business. I've been Groningen to try and turn the thing into a business. Then Brussels on the 20th. Strasbourg, I think, on the 25th. Trieve on the 26th.
Coming back to the UK at all?
I'm not scheduled to come back to the UK on this trip at this point. There is some space in the schedule later on. It's not too densely packed. I'd have to see what turns out to be possible, but I don't want to end up doing ridiculous amounts of crisscrossing Europe because, I mean, for one thing, it does cost, and, I live on donations, so I have to be careful what I end up having to pay, but, things might be possible. I'd have to see. Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those kinds of persons that I don't spend a lot of time thinking about money. I know other people, they're in much better situation than I am because they think about it, but that's just the way I am. And I find myself being a bit terrified.
Yes, that would be appropriate.
And, a family with mortgage and you have grown up kids that have that too. Mm-hmm. And what I'm thinking, I know I'll never be one to use too much time calculating what's the best thing to do. I agree, and I've convinced and that already before coming here, just this makes it seem even more urgent. Mm-hmm. What I think I need is how to not be terrified. Sincerely, that's what I'm feeling, strategies for how not to be terrified, and also maybe that we need follow-up workshops that say how given this do we build.
That would be a very good idea, because social cohesion is a wonderful way of not feeling terrified and alone. Just working with other people and building networks exactly like that, having workshops to say, okay, well, we're all in this together, and what can we do? And then you give each other mutual support. And that sort of thing is enormously important. It's very much the kind of thing that fits with what Transition tries to do. So definitely work with other people.
Mm-hmm. Are we living a lie? Are we living in fantasy?
Yes.
Is this going to collapse?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. But not. I'm not saying we go back to the Stone Age or anything like that. We go through a really serious period of upheaval. And for a lot of people, it's going to be very hard to take because a lot of people have only known expansion. They aren't old enough to have lived through darker periods or other times when things have been that much harder. So for a lot of people, it'll come as an awfully big shock. But it doesn't mean we turn into Mad Max. But we do move through a really, really challenging period. People are going to have a lot less, and they're going to have to simply make do. But people have been happy with a hell of a lot less long before now. You know, it can be done again. It's just a question of making the adjustment. And mental preparedness is actually really important. You know, if you're forewarned, then you don't feel like the rug has been pulled out from under your feet because you were kind of expecting it. And actually, if you expect the worst, then you'll be pleasantly surprised. You know, if your expectations are unrealistically high, you end up being horribly disappointed. So adjusting the expectations is a good thing to do in advance, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. This lady over here really, in a sense, gave me a beautiful precursor for something I was thinking, which is there are some amazing opportunities in here mm-hmm. for all of us, and I think we really need to work hard to get those, because I can relate to you feeling terrified. Not saying I feel quite that bad, but I can feel the pull in that direction. I'm sure a lot of people will. But mm-hmm. in your message, which is very powerful, and generally I don't like bleak messages because mm-hmm. I think we should act on the positive, but I think mm-hmm. there are times when they're very useful. I mean, like other people here, thinking about, well, what are my resources, what I'm going to do? Mm-hmm. If we can devise an answer to that, we have a huge amount of financial resources, skill resources, and all the rest.
Oh, yes, really transition is an enormous repository of these things.
Because yes. at the moment, I don't quite know what to do with the mm-hmm. money that I've got in the bank. I can hear mm-hmm. from you that that's not a smart place to leave it. Mm-hmm. But to put it into PV on my solar roof was one thing I was going to do until he asked his question. And it dawned on me that maybe that wasn't going to be rock solid either. But if I was to put my money into a pot along with other people from my community and say, well, what are we going to do that mm-hmm. is going to...
If you really, really time? Trust them, yeah. that can be done. Yeah. But make sure you really do. Human relationships are the stickiest things. They're the most important things, but they can really be sources of division if it's the wrong people that you're pulling resources with. It's more important to get the right people than to worry about structures, physical structures. If you have the right people, you can move mountains together in ways you could never hope to do on your own. Some people will be chucking in money, other people will have skills or time or whatever it might be. And the other thing that's important is to sort of regard everyone's contributions as equal on some level. So if people have a hierarchy out of it and they say, well, you know, of course, this is my money, so you know, you're kind of here on sufferance somehow. You can be here, but remember, this is mine. You know, that sort of thing doesn't work. You really do have to be more egalitarian than that. Otherwise, all you do is breed resentment, and then it tends to sow the seeds of its own destruction, which is really unfortunate. So it's tricky. It can be done, but it's tricky. And if you can have someone in there who's really, really, really good at human relationships, then that's excellent. Have someone whose primary skill is pouring oil on troubled waters and mediation, negotiation between different parties, because then you've got your built-in dispute resolution mechanism. You know, skills like that are underrated at the moment, but they're incredibly important. And there may be people who haven't got any money or sort of practical skills, as in hammer and nails or sewing machines or whatever, who may just be the most incredible social beings. They may not think they have anything to offer, but they absolutely do. That function is critical. So,
well, I'm part of the heart and soul bits of mm-hmm. transition, and I think that that's mm-hmm. where we get that from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of the sense of urgency you've been talking about, mm-hmm. I know a lot of us are really keen to go away and digest your slides and everything. I was wondering mm-hmm. if you have any objection to me just sticking on this memory stick and sending it out to the Transition Network.
I'll send you a copy of it. So if you email me, then I have my card here. But if you email me,
you gave
then...
You one last night.
Oh, okay. Yeah, if you email me, then I will send you a copy of the presentation. That's probably the best way of doing it. And things.
And then you'll circulate.
I'll send it out to the mm-hmm. Transition Network newsletter.
Okay, there's... I have a couple more of these.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, two things. One of those you mentioned that I think one of the components that Transition has is honoring the elders, but I think mm-hmm. it goes beyond the elders and it goes to the low income.
Good.
I'm from the States, and in Minnesota we have the brain drain from our small local communities, rural mm-hmm. communities, off up to the cities because that's where youth went, that's mm-hmm. where the jobs were.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have the wisdom and the experience of living a conservative lifestyle, mm-hmm. maintaining those small yeah. rural communities. And I think that tapping into that wisdom is still there. My mother is 85 years old. She was raised farming with horses and remembers when rural electrification came through. So that wisdom is not gone. And she we act like we've been living.
It's extremely valuable. You know, talk to people who lived through the Depression or World War II and rationing and all these things. Incredible resource. These people know how to live on next to nothing. And live well, happily at least. They wouldn't have been living at a high level of materialism, but then that's the problem anyway. We want to get rid of that. These people know how to make do. They can fix things. They know how to just function with a lot less money, a lot less material wealth, and they are a tremendous resource.
And they can remove the fear.
Yes.
So the other piece I wanted to ask you about is if you're familiar with Peter Schiff.
Yes. He comments on our site sometimes.
Okay. And so he's... I think he has a different political framework.
He does, and he has some very different opinions. He's a Sinophile, so he thinks investing in China right now is a great idea. I don't, because I think China's an enormous bubble. He's also an inflationist, and I'm not. I'm not saying that what he talks about wouldn't happen, but I would say it's 10 years down the line. You have to go through the deleveraging and the deflation before inflation is a threat. So inflation is probably at least 10 years away.
Well, the only thing I've heard him talk about, though, is money. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard him talk about climate or oil dependence.
No, he doesn't. Most finance people don't.
Well, and I guess what I'm looking at is that if we can connect with that community that is concerned about the economic aspect of it but doesn't recognize the connection and the dependency on the oil system or on climate change and what the impact of that is, how does your organization connect with that subculture group?
We're very different than most finance sites because, quite frankly, most finance sites are all about exploiting the misery of others for personal gain. So it's, water's going to be really scarce. Go and buy shares in the water company. Then you'll make a fortune when people are desperate. That's the kind of advice. It's all about investment, and it's all about making money. And so it's not about social responsibility or anything else. It's not about longer-term concerns either. We are what we are because we're totally separate. We are not part of that financial subculture, although we do primarily run a finance site at this point. We focus on finance because the time scale is shortest, not because we're trying to tell anybody how to go out and make an enormous amount of money. What we tell people is we're trying to help you not lose money. We're trying to help ordinary people rescue what they have worked so hard for all their lives from the grip of the system so that ordinary people get to keep some of it. Why should it all disappear into a giant black hole of credit destruction? Why should the bankers get it all? You know, ordinary people have a better claim on what they've worked for. So we're trying to tell people how to save that, how to rescue it and preserve it so that they will still have something to live on down the line, and they can then look after themselves and their friends and their families and build models that other people who didn't prepare can copy going forward, models as to how to do things in a constructive way, even in hard times. People will tend to do the headless chicken thing, and if there are models for doing things differently, then that can make a big difference to what happens when people are in headless chicken mode. If they see a model, then they can emulate it, and you don't have as deep a collapse. You don't have as much pain if there are functioning models for how things can be done differently. So what you're doing in transition is extremely important. You are creating functioning models for different ways to do things. It's incredibly important. And so I really like talking to transition townspeople because they're generally halfway there. They mostly don't tend to have enough of an understanding of how important finance is, but they understand climate and peak oil and various other things. They know we have to do things differently. So they're open-minded to all sorts of possibilities, and there's just this enormous wellspring of creativity as to how things could be done differently, which is fantastic. That's exactly what you need. Now, one needs to be realistic, though. And there will be constraints that a lot of people are not really thinking might be there. So some of the more optimistic things that I've heard, you know, the odds are not terribly good. But if one is realistic and operating within a framework that makes sense, there still is an enormous amount that can be done that's incredibly beneficial.
Sorry, just one last quick question. One of the initial slides that you put up there right at the very beginning, I think at the very top, was it the collateral debt obligations, the 60 years worth? Some of the research I've done about the potential financial explosion that can happen, it was at the top of one of your slides, and I thought it was the CDOs. It's like the 60 years worth of GDP, which is like...
Oh, the inverted debt pyramid?
Yeah.
Yes.
When is that? As far as I know, that's the spectre hanging over everything.
Yes,
when
it is.
When that goes off, that is it. Game over.
Yeah, and 80%
when is that?
It's hard to say. 80% of the derivatives market is invested in interest rate swaps and currency swaps. So if you have tremendous volatility in currency markets, that is going to destabilize the derivatives market enormously. And there is no capital adequacy regulation in the derivatives market. So you make bets. You don't have to prove that you're capable of paying off on your bet.
I get the impression that's imminent. That's
it's probably fairly soon. I think we're going to start to see meltdowns. And certainly the CDS market is one of the most vulnerable. That's credit default swaps. Because that's effectively insurance contracts on things you don't even have to own. So it's like saying that I could take out fire insurance on your house and then I might have an incentive to have an accident with matches. You know, that's what you can do with CDS. You can bet that something will go down and then you do your best to actively undermine it and make it fail in order to win your bet. Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. It's extremely common. But that structure combined with a lack of capital adequacy regulation that means that you don't even if you can force something under, you don't necessarily get anything because the person who took the other side of the bet often can't pay you. So you can force things under for no reason whatsoever. But you just force people, you can force things under for the idea being for personal gain, but then just end up not even getting anything out of it. It's a meltdown dynamic, though. It really is. And it is a $62 trillion market that has a built-in meltdown dynamic, and that's not a good thing, absolutely. So we are going to be looking at enormous problems in derivatives. There's just no question at all. It's only a matter of time, and I don't think it's going to take all that long. We're looking at a lot of years until we see a derivatives meltdown, I don't think. So I'm expecting markets to be hard down for till at least the middle of this coming decade. Not universally down. No market ever moves only in one direction. They always have rallies that keep people desperately hoping against hope that things will go back to normal. But nevertheless, I think the larger trend will be down till at least the middle of this coming decade. And then the depression would last longer than that, as it did in the 30s when the markets were hard down from 1929 to 1933, and then the depression lasted until 1939. So the real economy does lag the financial markets. So we're definitely looking at least a decade of really hard economic times. How hard is, at this point, not 100% clear, but it's not going to be nice. So, mm-hmm.
Can I give quite a practical scenario? If a community group is looking to invest, for example, £200,000 in an energy...
You can take all 5 minutes.
Okay.
If a community group is looking to invest, for example, £200,000 in a community energy project, and to borrow £800,000 or with £1 million overall total investment, getting feeding tariff...
I don't believe I would do that. I don't believe I would do that.
Okay, because this is quite a real scenario.
You might be able to scale the project down until you're not having to take on debt to do it, at least.
Okay, not to use debt. So.
Yes, if you're financing it with actual assets, you're not taking on debt. It's not necessarily a bad thing. You won't necessarily get the return you were promised, so you have to bear that in mind.
So borrowing money, it all communities. Individuals with giving money as an investment.
Yes.
The same as
community power is a good thing if you build it on existing pooled resources. It's only if you take on debt to do it and then you're critically dependent on the income stream you're promised that then dries up, that's when you have a real problem. But
if you could pay back debt within 5 years, but it's turbulent.
I think 5 years is probably too long, I would think. I'm not sure feed-in tariffs would die within 5 years. I think it may take longer than that. But it's one of those things that's a bit sticky. I think the risk of that is definitely there. The shorter the time frame you could repay the debt in, the greater the chance you might get away with it. But it's probably not a bet I would make at this point. Yeah. I should pack up, I think, because...